Hello, happy Monday. Welcome to the Stockout. I'm your host, Mike Bowden-Distel. This is our show at FreightWaves for all things related to the CPG and retail industries. And Grace is not going to be with us today, but it's just going to be me, and I'll be talking about the Unilever announcement last week, the ice cream divestiture, the job cuts, those things. General Mills, talk a little bit about their input costs, which are rising. I'll give an update on cocoa prices, which talk about an input cost that's rising. That one keeps hitting new records with sort of no relief in sight. So I'll talk about that a little bit, and then I'll provide a little bit of an update on the freight market using sonar. And if anyone didn't watch the State of Freight with Craig Fuller and Zach Strickland last week, would encourage people to go back and do that as well. But before I talk about those things, if anyone's not already signed up for the Stockout newsletter, I would encourage you to do that. Pretty easy. Just go to www.freightwaves.com/the Stockout, or you can just go up at the top of freightwaves.com, go under supply chains and click on the Stockout to be in your inbox. Tends to be towards the end of the week, Thursday or Friday. And there's also a discount code in there for anyone who'd like to attend the FreightWaves conference in Atlanta, which will take place June 4th and 5th. That's a great opportunity to network, great opportunity to see sort of what's happening in the freight industry. Really a good opportunity also to see a lot of the new and emerging companies in the freight tech space. Always lots of demos of new and emerging technologies. So it's a really great opportunity to see the industry sort of firsthand. So with that, I want to get into a first topic here, which is really sort of the big news. The story last week was there was the Unilever announcement that they were going to cut 7,500 jobs as part of this reorganization and divest the ice cream business. You take a look at the stock chart from last week, and you do see that took place March 19th. You see at the left side of that chart, stock bounced. I would say that the ice cream divestiture was not a surprise, should not have been. I think that was very much the speculation after the company reorganized its financials to break out ice cream in its own financial bucket, to break out nutrition in its own financial bucket. I think the cost reduction, sort of redoubling the efforts there, was was sort of driving that stock price reaction. So it was about 7,500 job cuts, they said, and out of a total employment base of 128,000. If you look at this next chart, this next stock chart, I think is an interesting one. So what I have here is a 5-year stock chart, stock chart performance for Unilever in black, and then its most similar company, which is Procter & Gamble, in blue. And you've seen Procter & Gamble really outperform Unilever the last few years, which is part of why I think Unilever attracted the activists. I mean, Nelson Peltz is the activist there. But all things considered, not surprised that the ice cream was divested. Ice cream basically revenue about $8.6 billion last year. And I think for all the news about the tweets and political positions that Ben & Jerry's takes, I don't think that was the reason of for it. I really think it is a situation where, like a lot of other CPG companies have done, where they looked at their portfolio of companies and divested some of the slower growth ones. I mean, investors are looking for growth, and you sort of go through the ice cream financials, and that's very much kind of what you see. Last year, the ice cream revenue grew 2.3%, which was slower than any other segment. And that 2.3% revenue growth was on volume that declined 6%, while prices rose 8.8%. So that's a pretty high elasticity in the world of CPG. So call it a 68% elasticity. A lot of these other segments in Unilever, less than 20%. A lot of sort of CPG in general, I would say it's kind of that 25 to maybe 35% range. So ice cream is something that people will cut back on when they see a price jump when they do see a price jump. And sort of eliminating that allowed the company to raise its medium-term guidance for revenue growth. They went from mid single digits up from low single digits. So they did increase the guidance there. They also said it's a little bit higher sort of margin profile overall after the ice cream was divested, and I think related to the job cuts and the streamlining of the the cost structure goes into that too. So very much similar to kind of what Nestle is doing, where Nestle calls it sort of cut the tail to move the head, which means get rid of the lower performing segments in order to accelerate growth, in the business. And then there's also a component of this, which is really sort of related to the supply chain, sort of close to our hearts here at FreightWaves, where you look at the ice cream supply chain and everything else at Unilever really have to be two distinct supply chains, because the ice cream, of course, has to be frozen. Whereas everything else, even a lot of the food products in the nutrition category, you think of things like Hellmann's mayonnaise. I mean, a lot of that can go along in the same trucks, the same intermodal containers, the same warehouses that the personal care items can go in. And with the ice cream, not only do you have to have this entire frozen network, but about 60% of their sales are for kind of consumption at home in a grocery store, which still leaves 40% that would go into something like an ice cream shop or amusement park or something like that. So it really does create a lot of additional complexities there. There's also a component of this where Unilever has pretty ambitious climate goals, like a lot of the CPG companies, particularly a lot of the UK-based CPG companies like Unilever. And the ice cream is higher carbon intensity because it has to be frozen. So the ice cream was accounting for about 10% of the company's greenhouse gas emissions. So that could have been part of it as well. Ice cream is also more capital intensive. Of course, it's more seasonal. But really, it's really sort of complicates the supply chain as far as who might be the buyer. Would agree with the analysts that have come out and said, well, it's unlikely it's going to be a strategic that's already in the ice cream business, because Unilever is so large, having 5 out of the 10 largest brands. So it could be private equity. It could be a financial buyer. But Unilever also said, well, it could most likely thing is just going to be spun off into another company that that's traded. So that's could potentially be able to invest in that as well. I want to move on to another CPG company that reported last week. General Mills is facing continued pricing pressure. Their stock chart is interesting. If you want to bring production, can bring that up. It's was really strong during the pandemic, where the stock price went from about $55 all the way up to $90, and then since retreated to $65. Now it's hanging in there at $69. And what they talked about during their analyst calls, really a lot of the input costs, which I think is something that people are looking at to say, well, some of these commodities are well off of their highs. Does that mean that we're going to see lower prices on the shelves? A lot of the CPG companies have said, well, even if those are down, a lot of their individual prices are down. And General Mills went into some detail about that. They said that their input costs have increased 32% since before the pandemic began. And the price of General Mills products this year is going to increase another 4%. Now, it is a lot better than the double-digit price increases last year, which was also true of a lot of the CPG companies, where a lot of those CPG companies had the retail prices increase in that sort of 15% range last year. But something that's more normal would be kind of that 2-3% price range, and really kind of that 4% price is kind of what's kind of critical, where consumers are a little bit more accepting of it. Typically that's something that Kroger has said in the past, that if it's 4% price increase, consumers will still kind of accept it. If it's higher than that, they start to see a little bit more elasticities kick in. General Mills in the last quarter, 1% decrease in net sales, with volumes declining, a couple percentage points. They attribute that to value-seeking behavior impacting both the channels of the company's business and also the size of the basket. So it does seem like there's a little bit more impact from consumers. Well, there you look at the stock chart, just how strong it was during the pandemic before falling off last year. CPG really had a hard time last year. Some of that was rotation of capital out of the safer names into tech stocks and those things. Some of that was the Ozempic thesis, but you really see that the fall off in the stock price, last year has recovered a few dollars. They said on the positive side, General Mills supply chain running very well, like it has been in throughout most of its history, with the exception of the pandemic. The pandemic was just a really kind of an odd situation where the company, was having trouble sourcing ingredients. General Mills specifically said it had times when I didn't know whether the trucks would show up, the trucks weren't showing up on time, all those type of situations. I do recall, Kraft Heinz talking about how at any given day, there was one sort of ingredient they were missing or one type of packaging material they were missing. But so those supply chains seem to be back and no longer, causing an issue, but still the cost inflation in the world of CPG, still a major issue. And a lot of consumers are sort of demonstrating that value-seeking behavior, changing where they shop, buying more private label, all of those things.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I want to move on to the next topic, which is the cocoa prices continue to surge. And this has just been kind of an extraordinary, situation here. So this is a chart that's in dollars per metric ton. And I have $8,872 per metric ton. This is the cash cost, and these also trade on sort of futures markets. But what's more typical is kind of a $2,000 to $3,000 range. Or if you get into a period where there's difficult growing conditions, maybe a $3,000 to $4,000 range. So it is almost five times, higher than what's typical. This is the highest price it's ever been, it beating the record back in 1977. And keep in mind, this is a chart that goes all the way back to 1980 that we're looking at now. And there was a good article in Just Food that went into some detail about this situation. I've talked about this on other episodes of the Stockout, but this Global Data predicts a fall in cocoa supplies of 8% in the 2023 to 2024 season. And then this other group, the International Cocoa Organization, predicts an 11% decrease in global production this season. So let's call it, 10 or 11% of decline in production this season. Analyst at ING Research says it's going to be the lowest stock of cocoa in 45 years, which makes sense. Highest price it's been in 45 years. And it's the weather conditions in Africa. The impact is really on this Ivory Coast. So about 40% of the cocoa beans are sourced from the Ivory Coast. And then Ghana, another 15% are sourced from Ghana. And supplies in those two countries specifically expected to decline 18% for the Ivory Coast and decline 19% for Ghana. So you have so much concentration of where the cocoa is sourced from. And then you've had really bad, weather, the El Nino with the droughts, the wind, the dry air. There's also a situation where it's coming off of a wet, condition where that can cause, was causing crop diseases. So entire crop yields were affected, which caused a production decline of about 10% from the high rains. And so kind of what could go wrong has gone wrong with the production there. And it's kind of interesting as sort of how that trickles to prices on shelves. A lot of that impact is not going to be fully, felt, at least immediately, because, the company like Mondelez, they come to an agreement with the retailers of how much what the prices are going to be. And they said in their analyst call in January that they agreed to what the prices were going to be in 2024 at that time. So some of these latest price increases not going to be felt, shouldn't be felt this year. They said Europe, for the most part, most of the prices were set as well. They can't pass it on immediately. That causes the CPG companies to have a pressure on their margins. Hershey's CEO Michelle Buck said their input costs will limit earnings growth this year. Some of it is hedged, but these price increases have been going on for long enough. Some of those hedges are starting to roll off. It's one thing that any of these companies that are involved in chocolates, you think of Hershey's being kind of the most obvious one. Mondelez is they have some of the biscuits and cookies, But you know, the chocolate's a big segment there too. They own Cadbury. You know, talk about one that's seasonally popular right now. So a lot of those, the CPG companies that are going to have some margin pressure as a result of those input costs. I want to move on to talk about the freight market, and I try to make this sort of not redundant with the really good overview that Zach Strickland and Craig Fuller provided last Thursday, which I would encourage everyone to go and review that if you haven't seen it already. But I'll talk a little bit about intermodal, which I think is one of the more interesting things that you can pull out of the Sonar data right now. So if you take a look at the AAR data, the intermodal volume is up, 10, 11%. If you just look at the domestic intermodal volume, which this is a chart in Sonar, which just shows domestic, and it's up just a couple percent, year over year. Now, part of that's because there was pretty strong comp with last year. So go back last year and domestic was outperforming international. But this year, it's really been kind of an international intermodal story. I want to turn to the next, Sonar chart shows the international intermodal volume. And you see the 2024 data is in white, and that's up over 20% year over year. And sort of a few reasons for that. So the big reason is that there's really been this big surge in imports coming into the port of LA and Long Beach specifically. Just saw a thing online that there's record volume of international intermodal on the BNSF coming out of Long Beach or that on-dock rail. And even with those record volumes, still the containers are piling up at the ports, and they need more intermodal well cars to move those containers out. So really, against an easy comp last year, international intermodal is way up this year. We're talking about international intermodal 20% plus versus domestic up only a couple percent. And you might say, well, why does this matter? And I think it really sort of matters depending on your perspective. If you're a financial analyst, a lot of those financial analysts will just be looking at these companies like J.B. Hunt, Hub Group, Schneider, Knight Swift. Those companies all compete in the domestic intermodal market. So if they're looking at the data that's not in Sonar, that's a little bit more widely available, such as from the Association of American Railroads, or data that's available on the Class One Railroads investor relations sites, they probably think that, the intermodal volume is up, 10% or 12% this year. Those companies' volumes should be up something like that as well. But those companies all compete in the domestic intermodal market. So you really need to know what's happening in the domestic intermodal market as opposed to international intermodal market to properly analyze those domestic intermodal stocks. So that's an important point. I think if you're a shipper, you might see, this is something where, if you just look at the AAR data and see that up 10%, you might think, well, maybe domestic intermodal capacity is going to start to get constrained. But since it's such a different market, that if you just look at the domestic intermodal and say, well, that's only up a couple percent, there's still domestic intermodal containers that are coming out of storage. There should be enough capacity there. So really, if your CPG company, which is one of the intended audiences of this, the show, a lot of the CPG companies will manufacture all their items in one centralized location, distribute those items throughout the country, and they want to pay attention to really sort of what's happening on the domestic side of things. And I really don't see any evidence that there's going to be any tightness in the domestic intermodal market, maybe with the caveat that there could be disruptions in rail service. And another person who would care, another group that would care about this would be importers. Because if you're a company that is doing a lot of importing, let's say from Shanghai to Chicago, it tells you that there's plenty of international intermodal containers. You go back during the pandemic, there was a lot more transloading of international cargo from international containers into domestic containers. And the reason for that was there was a shortage of international containers that needed to get back to China for the head haul market. That doesn't seem to be the case now because supply conditions were so tight during the pandemic. A lot of ships were ordered, but I think also a lot of containers were being manufactured as well. So there seems to be plenty of international containers despite carriers taking the long way around, the Cape of Good Hope. They're making up some of that with faster speeds, which has an impact, of course, on the carbon, but would not say that there's any impact, really on yet on availability of international containers. It seems like there's plenty of ocean going containers, in the marketplace. I want to turn to another topic that I wrote up over the weekend. It went out in the weekly update, and these are the weak, truckload prices are pressuring intermodal, volume, and I think intermodal, spot rates in, certain lanes. And the one lane I wanted to call out was the Chicago to Atlanta lane, which I think is an interesting lane for domestic intermodal because it is so competitive with truckload. And so this green line is the track spot rate. So that's a spot rate that we're getting from a consortium of logistics companies, brokers, 3PLs that provide to us, what they are paying for capacity. So they're the buy rates. And you see those have really come down a lot this year. So earlier this year, in February, $2.90 a mile on average. Those are going to include fuel. It's gone from $2.90 in February to $2.42. So call it a 50-cent drop. And so it's easier to source the truckload capacity. If you are going to Atlanta, you look at contract rates, still a lot higher than that $2.83. So if I'm a shipper, I'm thinking, well, the easiest way to get, the cheapest way to get from Chicago to Atlanta, something out, find some capacity on the spot market, which is different than it was, back in February. Kind of what a difference it's got kind of a month and a half, makes here. And you turn and put that in the context of what else is happening in Sonar. It does appear that maybe the primary reason for that is that truckload carriers are more willing to go to Atlanta because it's easier to get reloaded. And so one of the data series we'd like to look at in Sonar is called the Headhaul Index. So this is the Headhaul Index for Atlanta. And so this is going to compare the outbound demand in Atlanta versus the inbound demand in Atlanta. So you go back. On the left side of that chart, there was more freight coming out of Atlanta than into Atlanta. You look kind of in the middle of that chart, there was more coming in than going out. And so during that period of time, you'd be less likely to want to go to Atlanta if you're a truckload carrier. But in the last couple of weeks, that's kind of flipped to a headhaul market again. We have an 11 reading, which just means there's more outbound demand again than inbound demand. So that means carriers are going to be more willing to go to Atlanta, which means if I'm a shipper, let's say I'm a shipper in the CPG industry and I have a manufacturing facility in Chicago, all of a sudden carriers are more willing to go to Atlanta. Maybe I don't need to use rail intermodal. And it also brings into the question that Chicago to Atlanta lane is one that's heavily used by Norfolk Southern. And given that all that's happening with Norfolk Southern, with its activist situation, you have an activist investor at Norfolk Southern that wants to reduce costs, wants to, get rid of the CEO and COO and install its new board, new management team. I think the pressure is on Norfolk Southern's management team to reduce costs to the greatest extent possible. That could find its way into rail service, disruptions if they sort of cut into the bone there. A couple other charts, if we have them, the total outbound container volume is on the left from Chicago to Atlanta. And so, there's been a reduction in the domestic container volume from Chicago to Atlanta. So kind of in the middle part of that chart, which is in September of October of last year, there were about 320 containers a day. Let's say 320 to 330 containers a day. And these are domestic 53-foot containers in that Chicago to Atlanta lane. And then in the last week, that dropped to $287 containers. And so pretty significant reduction of about 30 or 40 containers a day. And, I would surmise that because the truckload rates have come down as much as they have, that there's been just been some freight diverted from truckload or from intermodal into truckload, just because it's cheaper to get it on the truckload side of things. And then what's also interesting is the right side of that chart is the intermodal contract rates. And those are intermodal spot rates, not contract rates. So those are spot rates to move 53-foot containers. Those are door-to-door rates. They include all fuel surcharges. And, not a lot of intermodal moves on the spot market, but it's still informative to look at what's happening with intermodal spot rates, because when they change a lot from one day to the next, something is happening in that market. And so you look at that in the last week, it went from $2.95 all the way to $2.39. And so you can say, look at that and say, well, there's a reason the the intermodal carriers cut the spot rates to that extent. And, you know, the reason I explained, you know, a couple minutes ago is really a loosening in the truckload market in that particular lane. And so it really sort of followed, the intermodal rates can tend to follow the truckload rates. And so that was a sort of a competitive response to what's happening in the truckload side of things. So if I'm a shipper that's running that lane, those are just some of the sonar charts sort of across mode that I would want to be looking at just to evaluate my supply chain. So keep those things in mind. If anyone needs wants to go through their lanes that they're running, happy to do that, or find someone here that will knows your industry really well. A lot of experts who came from various parts of the transportation industry from various different angles. So happy to put you in touch with someone. If you want to reach out to me, I can be found at mbowdendistel@freightwaves.com. Or also can be found at LinkedIn. Hear from some people. And with that, sign up for my newsletter and hope to see people at our conference in Atlanta.